Don't have enough time to sit down and read all the best Bitcoin articles? Well, let us read them for you. This is a Cryptoconomy Quick Read. All right, guys, welcome back to the Cryptoconomy Podcast. So, we have got part three of formalizing and securing relationships on public networks. We had a very, very long gap there. I didn't get an episode at all out last week. I basically just left my sound fort up, and I think I drove my wife crazy with that. Casually, like between like working on stuff, I would just come in, sit in here, record a couple of minutes of mastering Bitcoin, and then record a couple of minutes of this part three. And I kept thinking that it was just, oh, I'll just finish it tomorrow. Oh, I should be able to hit it, you know, here and here. And like this first part would get like 25 minutes long, 30 minutes long. I had a whole lot left over in this piece than I had thought. So I'm not 100% sure how long this is going to be. I'm pretty sure it's going to be over an hour. In fact, it looks like it's probably going to be an hour and quite a bit of change there, but we are completing it today. I just kept recording until finally I was done with the bulk of this, and then just kind of rambled at the end here for probably 15 minutes. But we are back at it. I've done most of the work on the bathroom remodel that I think I'm going to do, and I'm trying to hire out. I'm trying to talk with a contractor right now to get the rest of it sorted. So the sooner I can get that done, the better. I would be very, very happy to be back in my own bedroom. We have moved out into the extra bedroom, into the guest bedroom, and it is, it's a little stressful sharing one bathroom in the whole house and having a partial construction zone. It will be nice to have all the gaps closed and the nails nailed and the trim up and running and all bathrooms operational. So hopefully that happens sooner rather than later. But we will talk about part three here. I had a couple of notes that I wanted to hit. But without further ado, let's not delay any longer, and let's just go ahead and jump into part three. We will hit this, and I'm going to have a long read of this available pretty soon, maybe within the next day or two. So if you want to go back and listen to the entire thing without breaks or commentary or the intro music and all that good stuff, that will be available to everybody who just wants it as a quote-unquote audiobook version pretty quick here. And don't forget to check out cryptoeconomy.life. That is where I will post that, or, of course, on Twitter, at the cryptoeconomy. I will be dropping a lot of that, hopefully, this week, now that I'm finally getting back to it. All right, so waste no more time. Part three. Formalizing and securing relationships in public networks. Attacks against smart contracts. Protocols for smart contracts should be structured in a way as to make their contracts A, robust against naive vandalism, and B, robust against sophisticated, incentive-compatible, or rational attack. A vandal can be a strategy or sub-strategy of a game whose utility is at least partially a function of one's own negative utility, or it can be a mistake by a contracting party to the same effect. Naive simply refers to both lack of forethought as to the consequences of an attack, as well as the relatively low amount of resources expended to enable that attack. Naive vandalism is common enough that it must be taken into consideration. A third category, C, sophisticated vandalism, where the vandals can and are willing to sacrifice substantial resources, for example, a military attack by third parties, is of a special and difficult kind that doesn't often arise in typical contracting, so that we can place it in a separate category and ignore it here. The distinction between naive and sophisticated strategies has been computationally formalized in algorithmic information theory. The expected loss due to third-party attack is called the exposure. The cost of third parties to defeat the security mechanism is the disruption cost. If the disruption cost is greater than the expected benefit, we can expect an incentive-compatible attacker to disrupt the security. Public and secret key cryptography. One of the drivers of the trust cost revolution will likely be the wide variety of new cryptographic protocols that have emerged in recent years. The most traditional kind of cryptography is secret key cryptography, in which Alice and Bob, our exemplar parties to the contract, use a single shared prearranged key to encrypt messages between them. A fundamental problem we will see throughout these protocols is the need to keep keys secret, and public key cryptography helps solve this. In this technique, Alice generates two keys, called the public and private keys. She keeps the private key secret and well protected, and publishes the public key. When Bob wishes to send a message to Alice, he encrypts a message with her public key, sends the encrypted message, and she decrypts the message with her private key. The private key provides a trap door that allows Alice to compute an easy inverse of the encryption function that used the public key. The public key provides no clue as to what the private key is, even though they are mathematically related. The RSA algorithm is the most widely used method of public key cryptography. Public authentication. Public key cryptography also makes possible a wide variety of digital signatures. These prove that a piece of data, hereafter referred to as just an object, was in active contact with the private key corresponding to the signature. The object was actively signed with that key. There are two steps to an authentication protocol, signing and verification. These may occur synchronously, or in many public protocols, a signature may be verified at some distant time in the future. The digital signature probably should have been called a digital stamp or digital seal, since its function resembles more those methods than an autograph. In particular, it is not biometric like an autograph, although incorporation of a typed-in password as part of the private key used to sign can sometimes substitute for an autograph. In many Asian countries, a hand-carved wooden block called a chop is often used instead of autographs. Every chop is unique because the unique carving and wood grain cannot be copied. A digital signature is similar to the chop, since every newly generated key is unique, but it is trivial to copy the key if obtained from the holder. A digital signature relies on the assumption that the holder will keep the private key secret. A blind signature publicly authenticates privy information, but can we use non-privy signatures blindly as well? This is a digital signature and secret key encryption protocol that together have the mathematical property of commutativity, so that they can be stripped in reverse of the order that they were applied. It's like stamping an unknown document through carbon paper without having to worry about smudging. The effect is that Bob signs an object for which he can verify its general form, but cannot see its specific content. Typically, the key of the signature defines the meaning of the signed object rather than the contents of the object signed, so that Bob doesn't sign a blank check. Blind signatures used in digital bearer certificates, where Bob is the clearing agent, and in Chalmian credentials, where Bob is the credential issuer. Privy authentication. The blind signature is one example of the many magic ink signatures that cryptographers have invented. Another class of these protocols are used to limit the parties allowed to either verify the signature or to learn the identity of the signer. The most privy are the zero-knowledge proofs, where only the counterparty can authenticate the prover. Designated confirmer signatures allow the signer to designate particular counterparties as verifiers. For example, a business could give particular auditors, investigators, or adjudicators the authority to verify signed objects, while other third parties, such as competitors, can learn nothing from the signature. Group signatures allow members to sign as an authentic member of a group without revealing which member made the signature. Protection of keys. So far, we've assumed parties like Alice and Bob are monolithic. But in the world of smart contracts, they will use computer-based software agents and smart cards to do their electronic bidding. Keys are not necessarily tied to identities, and the task of doing such binding turns out to be more difficult than at first glance. Once keys are bound, they need to be well protected. But wide area network connections are notoriously vulnerable to hacking. If we assume that the attacker has the ability to intercept and redirect any messages in the network protocol, as is the case on wide area networks such as the internet, then we must also assume, for practically all commercial operating systems, that they would also be able to invade the client, if not merchant computers, and find any keys lying on the disk. There's no completely satisfactory solution to endpoint operations security from network-based attacks. But here's a strategy for practically defanging this problem for public key-based systems. All public key operation can be performed inside an unreadable hardware board or smart card on a machine with a very narrow serial line connection, i.e. it carries only a simple single-use protocol with well-verified security to a dedicated firewall. This is economical for high-traffic servers, but may be less practical for individual users. Besides better security, it has the added advantage that hardware speeds up the public key computations. If Mallet's capability is to physically seize the machine, a weaker form of key protection will suffice. The trick is to hold the keys in volatile memory. This makes the PC proof from physical attacks. All that's needed to destroy the keys is to turn off the PC. If the key backups can be hidden in a different, secure physical location, this allows the user of this PC to encrypt large amounts of data both on the PC itself and on public computer networks, without fear that physical attack against the PC will compromise that data. The data is still vulnerable to a rubber hose attack, where the owner is coerced into revealing the hidden keys. Capabilities. Object-oriented or capability security is a deep and promising area, but beyond the scope of this article. Capabilities can potentially simplify the design of many distributed security protocols. Instead of developing a new or modified cryptographic protocol for each contracting problem, capabilities may allow us to design a rich variety of distributed security protocols over a common cryptographic framework. For more information, see Introduction to Capability-Based Security, link provided. Quorum. Quorum distribution of performance or control over resources can be based on the secret sharing of keys needed to perform or control a resource. These are also known as threshold techniques. These are methods of splitting a key, and thus control over any object encrypted with that key, into N parts, of which only M are needed to recreate the key. But less than M of the parts provide no information about the key. Secret sharing is a potent tool for distributing control over objects between principals. Marcus Jacobson has designed a quorum of mints for signing digital coins, for example. Quorum establishes a, quote, required conspiracy of M out of N to perform a function, providing an option for stronger protection than the typical 2 out of N used in segregation of duties, and greater confidence in the security underlying the segregation. Post-unforgeable transaction logs. Traditionally, auditors have contacted counterparties in order to verify that a transaction actually took place, the, quote, principle of required conspiracy at work again. With post-unforgeable logs via a hierarchical system of one-way hash functions, a party can publicly commit to transactions as they are completed by publishing signed cumulative hashes of the transaction stream. The confidentiality of the transaction is fully maintained until an auditor, quote, pings the transaction to determine its actual nature. The counterparty identity can remain confidential because it is not required to establish the other facts of the transaction. The only attack is to forge transactions in real time as the transaction itself takes place, which in most practical cases will be unfeasible. Most accounting fraud involves analyzing sets of completed transactions and then forging them to make them compute to a desired counterfactual result. Mutually confidential computation. Cryptographers have developed protocols which create virtual machines between two or more parties. Multi-party secure computation allows any number of parties to share a computation, each learning only what can be inferred from their own inputs and the output of the computation. These virtual machines have the exciting property that each party's input is strongly confidential from the other parties. The program and the output are shared by the parties. So, for example, we could run a spreadsheet across the internet on this virtual computer. We would agree on a set of formulas, set up the virtual computer with these formulas, and each input our own private data. We could learn only as much about the other participants' inputs as we could infer from our own inputs and the outputs. There are two major complications. The first is that this virtual computer is very slow, one machine instruction per network message. The second is that some parties learn the results before others. Several papers have discussed the fraction of parties one must trust in order to be assured of learning the correct output. The mechanism must be constructed so that a sufficient number of parties have an incentive to pass on the correct result or reputation, side contracts, etc., used to the same effect. With these caveats, any algorithmic intermediary can, in principle, be replaced by a trustworthy virtual computer. In practice, because of the two complications, we usually construct more limited protocols out of more efficient elements. And here we just have a figure of four computers around a mutually trusted party. So we've got a third party in the middle showing each computer sharing the secrets and then receiving the outputs from that trusted party, and then comparing that to the mathematically trusted, trustworthy protocol in the example using the mutually trusted virtual machine, and instead they are passing encryptions into the virtual machine and then receiving their outputs, and there's no actual middle party in the situation between those four computers. Multi-party secure computer theory, by making possible privy virtual intermediation, has major implications for all phases of contracting. This can be seen most clearly in the area of negotiations. A mechanism in economics is an abstract model of an institution which communicates with its participants via messages and whose rules can be specified algorithmically. These institutions can be auctions, exchanges, voting, and so on. They typically implement some kind of negotiation or decision-making process. Economists assume a trusted intermediary operates the mechanism. Here's a simple example of using this virtual computer for a mechanism. Alice can submit a bid price and Bob an ask price to their shared virtual computer, which has one instruction, quote, A greater than B. The computer then returns true if Alice's bid is greater than Bob's offer. A slightly more sophisticated computer may then decide the settlement price according to a number of different algorithms. Alice's bid, Bob's ask, split the difference, etc. This implements the mechanism blind bargaining with no trusted intermediary. In principle, since any computable problem can be solved on this virtual computer, they are Turing complete, any computable economic mechanism can be implemented without a trusted intermediary. In practice, these secure virtual computers run very slowly. one virtual machine instruction per network message, and the order in which participants learn results often matters. But the existence proof that any economic mechanism can be run without a trusted intermediary up to temporal issues is very exciting. This means that, in principle, any contract which can be negotiated through a trusted third party, such as an auction or exchange, can be negotiated directly. So, in some abstract sense, the only remaining hard problems in smart contract negotiations are A, problems considered hard even with a trusted intermediary for the standard economic reasons, B, non-simultaneity problems in learning the decision, and C, the task of algorithmically specifying the negotiating rules and output contract terms. This includes cases where an intermediary adds knowledge unavailable to the participants, such as a lawyer giving advice on how to draft a contract. Applying this kind of analysis to the performance phase of contracts is less straightforward. For starters, economic theories of the performance phase are not as well developed or simple as the mechanism theory of negotiations. Indeed, most economic theory simply assumes that all contracts can be perfectly and costlessly enforced. Some of the transaction cost literature has started to move beyond this assumption, but there are few compelling results or consensus theories in the area of techniques and cost of contract enforcement. Performance phase analysis with multi-party secure computer theory would seem to apply only to those contracts which can be performed inside the virtual computer. But the use of post-unforgeable auditing logs, combined with running auditing protocols inside the shared virtual computer, allows a wide variety of performances outside the virtual computer to at least be observed and verified by selected arbitrators, albeit not proactively self-enforced. The participants in this mutually confidential auditing protocol can verify that the books match the details of transactions stored in a previously committed transaction log, and that the numbers add up correctly. The participants can compute summary statistics on their confidentially shared transaction logs, including cross-checking of the logs against counterparties to a transaction, without revealing those logs. They only learn what can be inferred from the statistics, can't see the details of the transactions. Another intriguing possibility is that the virtual computer can keep state over long periods of time, allowing sophisticated forms of privy and self-enforcing secured credit. With mutually confidential auditing, we will be able to gain high confidence in the factuality of counterparties' claims and reports without revealing, identifying, and other detailed information from the transactions underlying those reports. These provide the basis for solid reputation systems and other trusted third-party systems that maintain integrity across time, communications, and summarization, and preserve confidentiality for transaction participants. Knowing that mutually confidential auditing can be accomplished in principle may lead us to practical solutions. Contracts with bearer. Bearer certificates. Bearer certificates implement transferable rights onto standardized contracts. Each kind of contract, for example, each denomination of coin in digital cash, corresponds to a digital signature, just as each issue of Federal Reserve notes or stock certificates corresponds to a particular plate. In the most straightforward bearer certificate protocol, the issuer and transfer agent, the same entity for our purposes, though they can easily be unbundled, create a serial number, really a large, unguessable random number, rather than a sequence, and add it to a list of issued certificates. The transfer agent clears a transfer by checking the signature to identify the nature of the bearer contract and verify that it was made, then looking on that contract's issued list to make sure the serial number is there, then removing the serial number. Alternatively, the issuer can let the issuee make up the serial number, then when cleared, check the signature and put the number on the list of cleared certificates. The signature provides the assurance that the certificate is indeed the particular kind of contract with bearer, while the serial number assures that the same instance of that contract is not cleared or redeemed more than once. In these simple versions, the transfer agent can link the transferee to the transferor for all transfers. To implement the privacy characteristics of coins and physical bearer certificates, we need to add unlinkability features. Unlinkable transfers. Unlinkability can be provided by combining the second variation above, a list of cleared certificates, with blind signatures and a mixing effect. Enough instances of a standardized contract are issued over a period of time to create a mix. Between the issuing and clearing of a certificate, many other certificates with the same signature will be cleared, making it highly improbable that a particular clearing can be linked to a particular issue via the signature. There is a trade-off between the mixing effect and the exposure to the theft of a plate for a particular issue. The smaller the issue, the smaller the exposure, but the greater the linkability. A larger issue has both greater exposure and greater confidentiality. Blind signatures can be used to make certificate transfers unlinkable via serial number. Privacy from the transfer agent can take the form of transferee unlinkability, transferor unlinkability, or double-blinded, where both transferor and E are unlinkable by the transfer agent, or a collusion of a transfer agent and counterparty. Bearer certificates come in an online variety, cleared during every transfer and thus both verifiable and observable, and an offline variety, which can be transferred without being cleared, but is only verifiable when finally cleared, by revealing the clearing name of any intermediate holder who transferred the object multiple times, a breach of contract. This unlinkability is often called anonymity, but the issue of whether accounts are issued to real names or pseudonyms, and whether transferer or E identify themselves to each other, is orthogonal to unlinkability by the transfer agent in an online model. In the offline model, account identification, or at least a highly reputable and/or secured pseudonym, is required. Passing an offline certificate a second time reveals this identity. Furthermore, communications channels can allow Eve to link transferer and E unless they take the precaution of using an anonymous remailer. Online clearing does make a lack of identification a reasonable option for many kinds of transactions. Although common credit and warranty situations often benefit from or even require identification. When confronting an attempted clearing of a cleared serial number, we face an error or fraud dilemma, similar to the one we encountered above in double-entry bookkeeping. The eCash protocol from DigiCash actually takes advantage of this ambiguity, second transferring certificates on purpose to recover from a network failure. When certificates are lost over the net, it is not clear to the transferor whether they have been received and cleared by the transferee or not. Second transferring directly with the transfer agent resolves the ambiguity. This only works with the online protocol. The issue of distinguishing error from fraud is urgent in the offline protocol, but there is as yet no highly satisfactory solution. This problem is often intractable due to the subjectivity of intent. Conserved objects. Issuance and cleared transfer of references to a distributed object conserves the usage of that object. This object becomes scarce in economic terms, just as use of physical objects is finite. Conserved objects provide the basis for a software economics that more closely resembles economics of scarce physical objects. Conserved objects can be used to selectively exclude not only scarce physical resources, such as CPU time, network bandwidth, and response time, etc., but also fruits of intellectual labor, as long as one is willing to pay the price to interact with that information over the network rather than locally, compared to content rights management. Conservation immunizes objects and the resources they encapsulate to denial of service attacks. Bearer certificate protocols can be used to transfer references to a particular instance or set of instances of an object, just as they can be used to transfer other kinds of standardized rights. Digital cash. Digital cash is the premier example of a digital bearer certificate. The issue and transfer agent is called a mint. Bearer certificate protocols enable online payment while honoring the characteristics desired of bearer notes, especially unforgeability via the clearing mechanism, and transfer confidentiality via mixing and blinding. To implement a full transaction of payment for services, we often need more than just the digital cash protocol. We need a protocol that guarantees that service will be rendered if payment is made, and vice versa. Current commercial systems use a wide variety of techniques to accomplish this, such as certified mail, face-to-face exchange, reliance on credit history and collection agencies to extend credit, etc. Potential smart contract protocols in this area are discussed under credit. Content rights management. Content protection contracts are valuable in that they incentivize publishers to allow users to view content directly rather than indirectly and partially via queries to remote servers. Content protection of software distributed online would allow it to be run locally rather than remotely, while enforcing the contract rights and copyrights of the publisher against the user. This local usage billing of software often goes under the rubric of super distribution. Watermarks. Watermark schemes work by altering less significant bits of content, usually a picture. Sound works less well and text is difficult. These altered bits typically contain the identities of the publisher and viewer and perhaps other information related to the contract. The idea is that when investigators scan released content, the watermark will finger the breacher of the contract or violator of the copyright law. Watermark investigation can be assisted by a quite inexpensive technique, web spiders. These spiders look for redistributed watermarked material on the web. The customer originating the copy can then be fingered. One attack against watermarks is to overwrite likely watermark bits with other patterns legitimate to viewing software. The entanglement of watermark bits with bits important to the picture can be made rather obscure, but not strongly so by the standards of cryptography. Another attack is to steal content from a customer and distribute it as is. The watermark will finger the victim rather than the thief. All watermark schemes can be defeated with sufficient effort. These schemes can then be distributed as software worldwide. Once the initial effort is put into breaking a scheme, the marginal cost of breaking it is minimal. Furthermore, once the watermark is removed, the content can be distributed and even published with secure anonymity. In sum, watermark schemes can add significant risk to the copying of low-value or ephemeral information. This will be sufficient for many kinds of content, such as news or product updates. It won't stop for long the redistribution of high-value content. Since watermarks require traceable identification, they reduce customer privacy and require the inconvenience of registration and authentication, adding to the transaction costs of content purchase. Controlled CPUs. Contrary to the hype, there is no strong content protection software. Watermarks are as close as we've come, and they fall far short of the standards of computer security. Large sums have gone into attempts to develop such technology, resulting in hundreds of patents, but no substantial results. As a result, some publishers have begun putting their research dollars into a radical alternative, innocuously dubbed the Secure CPU, or SPU. This is a CPU that is, quote, secure against the owner of the computer. To enforce copyright or content contracts, the SPU monitors all content-related activity. Some marketing literature even lists, alongside the traditional copyright, a new right of publishers to monitor the usage of their content. Remarkably enough, these panoptic non-personal computers are the focus of major R&D efforts. The radical SPU projects demonstrate both the high value of content contracts to publishers and the high price we have to pay to maintain the paper-era intellectual property model online. Strong content protection would be valuable in going beyond indirect and partial viewing of content on servers to viewing content directly and locally. The price is the loss of control over our own computers and loss of privacy over our activities on those computers. The online content market is squeezed from above and below. From above, by the ease of redistributing high-value content. From below, by the mental transaction costs of charging for low-value content, costs to which the requirements of registration and traceable identification add substantially. The size of the market in between is an open question. Quote, information wants to be free, but authors and publishers want to be paid for it. The current content market for more difficult-to-copy media, such as books, films, CD-ROMs, and so forth, is large, in the hundreds of billions of dollars per year. But on the internet, free content dominates. Distributing ephemeral content in the form of service subscription is, in most cases, a more viable way to go. It remains to be seen how large the internet content market will become and to what extent customers will tolerate impositions on privacy and control of their computers in order to obtain legal content. Reputation systems. Reputation can be viewed as the amount of trust an agent has created for himself. Reputation systems ultimately need to be based on fact rather than mere opinion or faith to be effective. For example, if we are to have a good credit rating system, we need to be confident that the credit record assembled by the agency is sufficiently accurate. Reputation information is typically gathered and distributed by intermediaries trusted to perform this task. Reputation can take the form of a public database, such as credit rating services, or credentials issued by the tracking agency and carried by the user. A bearer doesn't want to show his negative credentials, so credentials are often only positive. But we want to protect ourselves against negative behavior sources as well as search out positive sources. Tags that bundle the results of a wide variety of transactions, global names or universal IDs or, quote, true names, may provide the most incentive for parties to carry their negative credentials. Most people have accumulated enough positive reputation in some areas that is well nigh impossible for them to start over their entire lives as newcomers. Robin Hanson has observed that in a world of global names, the use of a local name may signal the hiding of negative credentials, so that the use of global names is in equilibrium. A further problem with local names is that our relationships are often not neatly compartmentalized into standard service types, and even where they are, we might like to expand them into new areas. On the other hand, local names are essential for privacy. I suggest that we will want to reveal progressively more local names to our counterparties as our relationships with them become closer and more co-exposed. While the global name equilibrium may hold for many of our relationships, there may be plenty of areas where the privity benefits of localizing names outweigh the cost of being less or unable to differentiate newcomers from hostiles. For example, the preference tracking service at Firefly.com increases participation via the use of pseudonyms, thereby protecting customers from exposure to strangers who might abuse that information. On the other hand, credit transactions typically demand identifying information because the contractual exposure typically outweighs benefits of privity. Global name public keys, which have many drawbacks in terms of privity, may be the best way to track negative reputation, but they are no panacea. There is an important conundrum on an ID-based key system: the conflict between the ability to get a new key when the old one is or could be abused by another, key revocation, and the ability of another to be sure they are dealing with the same person again. This may also provide an opportunity for parties to selectively reveal positive credentials and hide negative ones. For example, a person with a bad credit rating could revoke the key under which that rating is distributed and create a new one, while selectively updating their positive credentials to the new key. For example, have their alma mater create a new diploma. The current universal non-cryptographic key in the U.S., the Social Security number, is very difficult to revoke. It's much easier to change your name. This policy is probably no accident, since the biggest economic win of global name identification is the tracking of negative reputations, which revocation can defeat. As long as the Social Security number is a shared database key, not used for the purpose of securely identifying a faceless transaction, there is little need for revocation beyond the undesired erasure of negative history. Combining a secret authentication key, which must be revocable, with a public universal ID is quite problematic. Credit. One of the basic outstanding problems in smart contracts is the insurement of credit. This comes up not only in loans, but in any other contract which involves a temporal lag between performance and reciprocal performance of the contractual terms. In current practice, there are several partially effective processes for ensuring future performance. 1. Reputation, especially credit reports, often effective but only to a point, as it is often hard for the debtor to accurately judge the future reputational effects of an action. For instance, failure to pay a bill, taking out too large a loan, etc., that has clear local beneficial effects today. There's more imbalance in knowledge between current and distant consequences among individual consumers, but even among large organizations with high credit ratings, it is not an irrelevant factor. 2. Secured transactions like liens, escrow, etc. 3. Garnishment of future income. And 4. Law enforcement, especially to enforce transfer of control over liened assets, garnishment, etc. These processes have a fundamental property in common. They violate the privity of credit transactions. In other words, they bring in third parties to track reputations or enforce repayment. Do credit transactions entail a fundamental imbalance in incentives that can only be redressed by bringing in third parties? Or can the security protocols be discovered which allow credit with minimal or no third-party involvement? Local name credit ratings. Three important variables have been proposed for reputation economics. First, operating value, the expected future profits given the reputation. Then throwaway value, profit from cheating, which ruins reputation. And replacement cost, the cost of recreating reputation. In turn, Peter Swire describes two problems facing inadequately secured or unsecured loans to, quote, credit names. Adverse selection. Prior deadbeats can start fresh by signing up for the new service. Going in, it will be biased in favor of deadbeats. This problem may be addressed by using Chalmian credentials. These allow the established positive reputations of previous names to be carried over to the credit name without allowing anyone to link the two names. Entrants without positive reputations can be rejected. The end game problem. A credit name can establish a good credit rating over time. When the limit is high enough, the borrower can quickly spend it all. A malicious borrower with a good rating established under a previous name can systematically profit at the expense of the lender if the throwaway value is greater than the replacement cost. To address this problem, creditors will have to charge higher rates to new credit names and raise credit limits more slowly than for traceable names. Honest borrowers will subsidize the dishonest to an even greater extent than they do in the current credit card system. Secured credit. Secured credit need not violate privity if the physical control over the securing property can be shared. So that, for example, automobile credit can be secured as long as repossession is possible, as described in the example above. A standard mechanism of secured credit applicable online is the escrow. An escrow is an intermediary trusted to hold messages until messages from both sides are received and, optionally, their contents verified, to extent the content is verifiable and at the expense of some privity. The escrow then sends the messages off to their recipients along with receipts. Messages can contain any sort of data, content, a bearer certificate, etc. Ripped instruments. Alice wants a New York City cab ride for which she is willing to pay $100, but she doesn't trust Bob the taxi driver to get her there on time if she pays up front. Bob, in turn, doesn't trust Alice to pay at the end of the trip. Commerce can be consummated by Alice tearing a $100 bill and giving half to Bob. After the trip, she gives the other half to Bob, which he can then reassemble into a negotiable $100 bill. Alice loses her incentive to not pay. Bob gains incentive to get her there on time as promised. Both have made what economists call a credible commitment to perform their respective parts of the contract. Marcus Jacobson has digitized this idea, coming up with a protocol for ripped digital cash. As with many other aspects of digital cash, the idea can be further generalized to rip some other kinds of bearer instruments, specifically those whose value can be divided roughly in half. If the transfer is double-blinded, the transfer agent has no knowledge of the participants and therefore no bias to favor one over the other. The transfer agent must, however, be able to assess proof of performance, and the protocol is only workable where such proof, in the form of proof of receipt of a message, for example, is available. The ripped bill is similar to using the transfer agent as an escrow agent. An advantage over using an escrow agent is that the need for extra anonymous channels between the parties and the escrow is avoided. A disadvantage is that the transfer agent now has taken on the major additional job of acting as an adjudicator, assessing proofs of performance, or at the very least, must be responsible for subcontracting out this job and implementing the adjudicator's judgment. Credit cards. Credit cards provide relatively little protection from third parties, especially in the area of privacy. But they do have an interesting contractual feature worth noting, the chargeback. With chargebacks, customers can get refunds on allegedly unwanted merchandise. The issuer tracks the number of chargebacks both for customers and merchants. Too many chargebacks can get you booted out of the system. This provides an efficient mechanism for refunds without resorting to expensive tort proceedings. Many customers who read the fine print or otherwise learn about chargeback limits often do chargebacks despite receiving and enjoying the merchandise. There is no practical way for the issuer to detect such fraud, and so it can only be pruned by limiting the number of chargebacks per customer. Some merchants complain vociferously about such customer theft, and it seems to make possible coordinated attacks to put merchants out of business. But nevertheless, merchants sign up for credit cards because that's what their customers have signed up for. The chargeback feature makes customers more comfortable purchasing goods of unknown quality, especially mail order and over the internet. Chargeback provides a crude but effective partial solution to the information asymmetry problem between retailers and consumers. Interval instruments. time release money that becomes good only after a certain date, and interval money that would expire after a certain date have been proposed. These can be implemented by a digital mint expiring or activating special issues of digital cash, or by a third party issuing escrowed keys at specific times. Since these keys are encrypted against the escrow agent, and that agent doesn't know what they will be used for, the escrow agent has no incentive to cheat. A generalization of this is that transfer and redeemability are each associated with interval sets, or validity periods, when each can and cannot be performed. This is analogous to clipping coupons on bonds. Known borrowers of unknown amounts. Hal Finney has described a loan mix to unlink borrowers from amount borrowed. The identity of the potential borrowers is still public, as well as the system for enforcing payment, but the actual amount loaned or borrowed remains unknown. The system starts with participants putting unknown amounts into a pot and getting receipts, or bearer bonds, for these amounts. All participants then borrow a standard amount. Whether a participant is a net borrower or a net creditor, and of what amount, remains private. When the loan is due, all participants repay the standard amount, and the creditors reclaim the amounts on their bearer bonds. The amount actually borrowed, or if negative, loaned, is the public amount borrowed minus the amount put into the pot. One consequence is that while negative reputations can still be accumulated when participants fail to pay back the standard amount, positive reputations are minimal, since participants who borrow and loan are indistinguishable. If future creditors put stock in positive participation, one could gain a credit rating by perpetually participating as a net borrower of zero by loaning and borrowing the same amounts. Conclusion. Smart contracts combine protocols, user interfaces, and promises expressed via those interfaces to formalize and secure relationships over public networks. This gives us new ways to formalize the digital relationships, which are far more functional than their inanimate paper-based ancestors. Smart contracts reduce mental and computational transaction costs imposed by either principals, third parties, or their tools. Mark Miller foresees that the law of the internet and the devices attached to it will be provided by a grand merger of law and computer security. If so, smart contracts will be a major force behind this merger. All right, we have concluded Formalizing and Securing Relationships on Public Networks by Nick Szabo. Again, written all the way back in 1997, or originally published in 1997. And there's a lot of really, really good details about, like, specific trade-offs and stuff that, like, just kind of going through this stuff, like there's a lot of assumptions that you make just about the levels of new features or use cases opened up by something like just Bitcoin in general as a public network, like triple entry accounting, so to speak. It's really interesting, particularly like the whole reputation system discussion. It's a rather short section in this one, but I thought that was really interesting because he talked about the difference between a key that should be revocable and one that should not. Like any kind of public key, like secret authentication key, must be revocable. I mean, you know, a GPG key just has an expiration just kind of by default. But with a public universal ID, like attaching that to a public universal ID makes it very difficult to cross that, like to, if one key is revocable, you end up having to essentially leave the rules of the system in some regard in order to enforce the other. So if you're trying to continually use a public universal ID, but you're going to revoke these secret keys because they could be stolen or let's say someone else like steals it and abuses it. In one of those cases where you want to renew your secret authentication key, let's say we're already in a situation where that key is no longer secured, you have to reach out to a different, like it suddenly becomes a problem of needing a third party to verify who you are. Like you leave the security of that public key system and revert back to, okay, this person says I am who I am and here's all my identifying information, to revoke that old key and implement a new one attached to the public universal ID. So that sort of universal ID is still limited to kind of what we can prove or show in the real world. It's kind of like, even though you might have one on some public network and it's online, its verification or reliability is still based in kind of a paper era world. Because he talks about like the biggest win of the global name identification is the tracking of negative reputations. So if you can revoke old keys very easily, well, then there's no benefit to tracking. There's no sustainability to a negative reputation. And that's also a problem with local versus global naming. Like if I've got a local pseudonym, you don't have any idea what my reputation was on, you know, some other website. Like let's say I'm trading on one exchange and I've got this whole other reputation on another exchange and I'm using two different pseudonyms for each one. I might have a terrible reputation. Like technically I could screw everybody over on one and then use that to build up a great reputation, use my profit from screwing everybody over to build up a great reputation somewhere else. So there's a lot of big trade-offs, and when you don't think about it too hard, you just kind of think, oh, this would be brilliant for reputation, but you kind of run into a lot of the same problems outside of the fact that your actual ownership of the money or the contracts involved can now be created as bearer instruments. So it does change the game, but it doesn't – there's not as huge a shift in kind of the overarching, like, okay, this problem is now very simple, that you might expect. Like, it's still not just a problem of the code, like a Bitcoin transaction or a contract is written in Bitcoin. And it's funny because we've been able to observe in the last, well, really since Bitcoin and kind of the darknets and stuff, because the darknets in particular are something that's really interesting to look at from that standpoint, from those, what was the three different, there's the operating profits, how much is that reputation worth? Hold on a second, let me find this actual section so I can read this. Post unforgeable. Man, this thing is so long. I've spent literally most of the week, all last week, recording little bits of this in and out. I kept thinking that, oh, I'll be done with it this time, and it ended up being a whole nother, I guess at this point, this is my second section, so this is already 30 minutes. There's no telling how long this is. It's probably over an hour was part three at this point. Okay, here we go. Local name credit rating. So you've got operating value, which is your expected future profits given the reputation. So let's use this as an example, like the dark net markets, because they're the best example of something where you have pretty much full, well, yeah, you have full privacy. The goal is full privacy, and but to still be able to write a smart contract and build a reputation system despite the fact that you have no idea who you're doing business with. And there was a really good article. It was like, is it at MIT? I can't remember where I read this. It was a paper. I think I ran into it from an article, but there was some paper. I should have saved that. I don't think I have that saved somewhere. I'm going to have to dig through my folders and folders of just random stuff to read here. But there was a brilliant piece written, like, analyzing the darknet markets. And basically, I think it was titled something along the lines of "The Darknet Markets Survive Because of Great Customer Service." And it talked explicitly about some of those trade-offs of like how, like as they build up reputation, vendors with no reputation whatsoever, we just couldn't do business, and you had to have, even if you attempted to screw somebody over, you know, you had to have 10, 20, 30 trades or sales or whatever it was under your belt to build up a reputation, but then your operating value becomes greater because now you've got this bit of a history where people are reaching out to you to do business and you can make profits, but you know, what are you going to do? You're going to screw over one customer for whatever it is, $200, $500, I don't know. You're going to cheat that one customer and then have to do all this over again to get another 20 or 30. Like how much work is that for that tiny amount of profit? And that's the throwaway value, the profit from cheating, which ruins the reputation, and then the replacement cost, the cost of recreating that reputation so that you essentially have a means of cheating people again. And I thought that was really interesting because you saw some of these, like a lot of the exchanges, or not exchanges, the Silk Road, the major websites, the eBays of the dark net, so to speak, have been either shut down or exit scammed. And it's funny, you get to that point where one of the problems is the longer they stay open, the more likely they are to eventually get caught. That the police or whoever is going to come in and shut them down, like it's going to get exposed. And so the longer it lasts, the more at risk they are of running an operation like that. And then if they have a custodial model, you're looking at a situation where more and more people have put their funds into these wallets. So the throwaway value, as their operating value goes up, we're looking at like kind of a fourth parameter of enforcement risk, where a state, whatever contraband is being sold in whatever country or whatnot, obviously we're talking about illegal goods here, so some state somewhere is going to be after them. This is the whole point of the darknet markets, is to get around the law. So just as time passes, that risk of essentially losing everything, the full loss cost continues to increase. That risk of that happening continues to increase. And at the same time, your operating value is continuing to increase. But because some of these darknet markets were custodial, I haven't been reading up on my darknet market stuff for a while, but I'm pretty sure one of them, I feel like there's one that's non-custodial now that, like, I think is just kind of like what's like Open Bazaar sort of. Well, it's not a software. I think it's still a website, obviously. But I don't know. I haven't really done research. This is just kind of off the top of my head because I think it's such a fascinating way to analyze the degree of privacy in smart contracts and kind of the use case of a system like Bitcoin, because it enables this, even though we still have all these trade-offs. But basically what happens is you get to the point where the throwaway value is so high, like the profit from cheating is so high because you've got your operating value large enough that there's, you know, $50 million, $100 million deposited on these services, on these platforms, and they know that the longer they stay there, the longer they stay in business, the more likely they are to lose everything. So suddenly, as time goes on, it looks more and more, it just looks better and better to just kind of shut the whole thing down, take everybody's money, and bail on the entire situation. And that's basically what you saw. There were a handful of times where I was reading about a darknet market that had been around for a year and a half, and they'd grown really big and people really enjoyed them, and then they just scooped up $50 million worth of customer coins or whatever and just left. And the article, one of the articles that I was reading specifically that stuck in my mind was how they were talking, they interviewed some big vendor names or whatever in the darknet markets, and they talked about it. It's like, yeah, man, it's just kind of, it's part of working in this space, is that you know that trade-off is there, and that at some point that's pretty much going to happen, and it's pretty much a cost you have to allocate into doing business on these markets. But it was just a really interesting thing, and I loved that piece written up about how darknet markets survived because of good customer service. And like I said, it's such an interesting use case because it's a market that you can't test any other place. You know, like you can't really look at data on. And this is the perfect example of smart contracts, like of how Bitcoin or Monero, would basically an open cryptocurrency, provides in making you able to do business in significant amounts of money. Like every time I look at, you know, data on it, I mean, the police talk about it, it's billions and billions of dollars of drugs being moved. And the fact that there can be that much business entirely in private, where everybody is working off pseudonyms and reputation systems, is really fascinating, regardless of, you know, what it is being traded. In fact, the fact that it's contraband is what makes it so interesting, because it's such a high risk market, and yet it works so well with these tools enabled, tools enabling for trust minimized relationships between the vendors and the buyers, and being able to protect themselves from whatever aggressive police or government or whatnot that's essentially trying to stop them or prevent them from doing business. And I think this kind of falls in line with the trade-off, well, the cost incurred with credit cards, and talking about how the intermediaries or the third parties or the issuer would just track the number of chargebacks and then limit a specific number of chargebacks per customer or merchant, so that you would just be booted from the system, which is an efficient mechanism and low cost, because they don't have to go at any specific they don't have to dig into the details of a bunch of specific cases of purchases and who cheated who or whatever. But it's a huge problem for the merchants, because the merchants have, you know, they're getting stolen from by these customers. It's too easy to do a chargeback even after you received and enjoyed the merchandise that you're trying to purchase. But that makes the darknet markets a great example of exactly that kind of thing, because the market itself is typically the escrow agent. It's eBay. It's literally eBay with Bitcoin, but just showing the power of the fact that there's no direct third party involved in the transaction. And I think continued development in smart contracts and scripting on Bitcoin, and then like modifications to Lightning transactions. Like there's the, I think Alex Bosworth talked about something called the HODL HTLC, which is like an ephemeral Lightning invoice that like you pay and it sits in limbo or something until it's essentially a Lightning network escrow type transaction, and it can actually be reversed very quickly if the parties agree. So it's really interesting how, like, we might be. I mean, that's what a Lightning payment is when you think about it. It's a two party like escrowed payment that's locked with a time lock, and so there's actually no third party involved, but you still have a very, very trust minimized relationship. You don't really care who it is that you're connecting to. You're really more worried about their relationship on the Lightning network. Like, how good of a node are they? How well connected are they? You're not really worried about the person in particular, because if they tried to broadcast a bunch of cheat transactions, you would just close your channel with them. And yes, it would be an added cost, and it would be a frustration, and you'd have to, you know, you have to reset up channels or whatnot, depending on how many you had with that node. But still, it's a huge, huge difference between having to trust somebody else with your money or with some direct control over funds in the relationship, and being able to extend that to give the customer that comfort, that ease of knowing that they can always get their money back in the case of dispute. but also solving the problem with the merchant, where the customer can't just blindly issue chargeback and not have any consequences of it. Like, it's basically a chargeback only in the situation where, let's say we've got a third party that's a third key involved in the transaction, whether it's like an eBay or an Amazon or some sort of service like that, or it's just a case of falling back to the blockchain and having a provable sequence of events that happened, and you being able to publish the latest event, even if they want to publish like a previous state. So it adds a huge degree of security. It basically mimics the security and comfort of chargebacks on credit cards, like for customers knowing that, okay, I can buy this product and I know that I don't have to release the money. They're not going to be able to get this money and leave until I know I've got my product and that it's good quality and it works, it's not smashed or whatever. But then also give the merchant the basically that same guarantee, rather than leaning it so heavily towards the customer, that if they ship out their product and they fulfill their end of the bargain, they're going to get their money. And they've essentially ripped, it's a ripped instrument. It's like that $100 bill. We've ripped it in half and it's useless until one person gives the other half of that bill forward or backward to whoever was involved. And they're both risking knocks on their reputation if they do not do the honest, they do not make the honest exchange for those ripped bill pieces. So it's just really interesting. I was eager to get to this one because I had started reading like half of it and I knew there was going to be like a bunch of really good stuff in here. So I just stopped and I was like, all right, it's time to just start recording this one. I think I'm going to have pretty soon. Sorry, I've missed so much time here in getting episodes out, but I think I'm going to get like a collection together. I think it's time. I've got enough pieces read by Nick Szabo that it's time to just get a collection together of his work, or at least a page of Nick Szabo, so that people can explore all the things. Because I constantly find people who just have no idea that there's an audiobook version of shelling out, or, you know, formalizing and securing relationships on public networks, because there's just a there's just so many great points in the detail with which he, like, granularizes a lot of these problems and talks about the trade-offs, like what you can do with privacy and what you can't do, and where that privacy is results in a higher benefit to the customer versus a higher benefit to somebody who's trying to cheat in the relationship. It's just really fascinating stuff, and I don't know anything that's as dense as Szabo's work on these topics. And obviously, I have read a ton of stuff about all of this, and I still am constantly reading. I will literally reread something by Nick Szabo and catch something that I hadn't before because it was one level deep. I'll hear some sort of new topic or perspective on something that I hadn't heard before, but not yet know how to apply it. So I'll spend a couple of days thinking about it, and then I'll go back and listen to it. Or scroll over that section again when I'm trying to think up comments or things to talk about in the commentary. And I'll read it again, and I will realize that there was a paragraph after that that I completely didn't understand because the perspective was so new to me when I first read it. So these are great ones to re-listen to. They are dense. Some of his word choice is a little out there, which makes it slightly hard to follow. But it's just, there's so much good stuff here. You don't want to miss out. So I'm going to try to get that out this week, hopefully. That's kind of what I'll be focusing on outside of getting back into the swing of things with regular episodes. And hopefully we can have Nick Szabo's either collection or just a page dedicated to him, because I've been wanting to have something for just strictly authors for a while. And he's obviously the perfect one to start on. And as I said before, a huge thank you to Nick Szabo if you listen to this. And you guys should extend thanks out to him because he's given me free rein to read anything that he's ever published in audio and make it available to you guys. And that's just awesome because the body of work is pretty freaking amazing. All right, I'm going to stop it there. I'm going to quit rambling. I hope you guys enjoyed this amazing three-part series. I am going to, or three parts of one piece. I'm going to put these together and do a long read of it so you'll have it in full as an official quote-unquote audiobook without the intros and exits and all that good stuff. Don't forget to check that out on cryptoeconomy.life. That should be posted up pretty soon. And I will catch you guys next time. We are back in action. Sorry about that gap there. But don't forget to follow me on or at The Crypto Economy on Twitter. And check out the website at cryptoeconomy.life, where you can find all of the amazing stuff that I am working on and reading. And there's still plenty of stuff in the works. We get right back at it. I will catch you next time on the Crypto Economy Podcast. Till next time, take it easy, guys.